because none of us has remembered to eat enough all day. I remove a glove and eat two small rolls of bread, so light and filled with air that they seem to dissolve on my tongue. At the center of each is a mass of honeyed raisins and nuts. Their sweetness, enough to bring tears to my eyes. Maddox passes me a slab of pale yellow cheese and a still bloody slice of juniper and pepper-crusted venison. We make quick work of the food. I spot Maddox's red cap, half in and half out of his front pocket. His version of a medal, I suppose, to be worn on state occasions. None of us really speaks. I do not know what the others dwell on, but abruptly, I realize I am going to have to dance. I am terrible at dancing, since I have no practice in it other than humiliating lessons at school, partnered with Taryn. I think of the ghost and the roach and the bomb, trying to safeguard Dane against whatever Baelkin has planned. I wish I knew what to do, how to help them. Kill the bearer of this message. I look over at Maddox, drinking spiced wine. He seems entirely comfortable, totally unaware of, or unconcerned with, the loss of one of his spies. My heartbeat drums faster. I keep remembering not to wipe my hand on my skirts for fear of smearing them with food. Eventually, Oriana pulls out some handkerchiefs soaked in rose and mint water for us to wipe ourselves down with. This sets off a chase, with Oak trying to avoid being washed. There isn't far for him to run in the carriage, but he keeps it going longer than you'd think, stepping on all of us in the process. I am so distracted, I don't even automatically brace when we go straight through the rock and into the palace. We're lurching to a stop before I even notice we've arrived. A footman opens the door, and I see the whole courtyard, filled with music and voices and merriment. And candles, forests of them, the wax melting to create an effect like termite-eaten wood. Candles rest atop tree branches, flames flickering with the whoosh of dresses sweeping below. They line the walls like sentries and clump in tight arrangements on stones, lighting up the hill.
"Ready?"
Taryn whispers to me. "Yes," I say a little breathlessly. We pile out of the carriage. Oriana has a little silver leash she attaches to Oak's wrist, which strikes me as not the worst idea, although he whines and sits in the dirt in protest like a cat. Vivienne looks around the courtyard. There's something feral in her gaze. Her nose flares.
"Are we supposed to present ourselves to the High King one last time?"
she asks Maddox. He gives a half-shake of his head.
"No, we will be called forth when it is time to take our oaths. Until then, I must stand beside Prince Dane. The rest of you should go enjoy yourselves until the bells chime and Val Morin begins the ceremony. Then come to the throne room to witness the coronation. I'd have you close to the dais, where my knights can look after you."
I turn toward Oriana, expecting another speech about not getting into trouble, or even a new speech about keeping my legs closed around royalty. But she is too busy pleading with Oak to get out of the road.
"Let's party,"
Vivi says, sweeping Taryn and me along with her. We escape into the crowd, and moments later, we are drowning in it. The Palace of Elfheim is packed with bodies. The unallied wild fae, courtiers, and monarchs mingle together. Selkies from Queen Orla's court of the undersea speak together in their own language, skins slung from their shoulders like capes. I spot the lord of the court of termites, Roybin, who is said to have killed his own lover to win a throne. He stands near one of the long trestle tables, and even in the cramped hall, there is space around him, as though no one dares get too close. His hair is the color of salt, his garments entirely black, and a deadly curved sword sits at his hip. Incongruously, beside him, a green-skinned pixie girl is dressed in what appears to be a pearl-gray slip dress and heavy lace-up boots. Obviously mortal clothes. And standing on either side of the pixie are two knights in his livery, one with scarlet hair braided into a crown on her head, Dulcamera, who lectured us on the crown. There are others, figures I have heard of in ballads, Rue Silver of New Avalon, who cut her island out of the California coast, is talking to the exiled Alder King's son, Severin, who might try to ally with the new High King, or might join Lord Roybin's court. He's with a red-haired human boy about my age, which makes me pause to study them. Is the boy his servant? Is he enchanted? I can't tell just from the way he looks around the room. But when he sees me staring, he grins. I turn quickly away. As I do, the Selkies shift, and I spot someone else with them. Gray-skinned and blue-lipped, hair hanging around her sunken-eyed face. But despite all that, I recognize her. Sophie. I had heard stories about the merfolk of the undersea keeping drowned sailors. But I didn't believe them. When her mouth moves, I see that she has sharp teeth. A shudder ripples across my shoulders. I stumble along after Vivi and Taryn. When I look back, I don't see Sophie, and I am not entirely sure I didn't imagine her. We slide past a shag foal and a bar guest. Everyone is laughing too loudly, dancing too fiercely. As I pass one reveler in a goblin mask, he lifts it and winks at me. It's the roach.
Heard about the other night?
Good work, he says.
Now keep your eyes out for anything that seems amiss. If Belkin's going to move against Dane, he's going to do it before the ceremony starts.
I will, I say, pulling free of my sisters to tarry with him a moment. In a crowd this size, it's easy to be briefly lost.
Good. Came to see Prince Dane win the crown with my own eyes.
He reaches into his leaf-brown jacket and pulls out a silver flask, popping the top and taking a swig.
Plus watching the gentry cavort and make fools out of themselves.
He holds the flask out to me with one gray-green clawed hand. Even from there, I can smell whatever is inside. Pungent and strong, and a little swampy. I'm okay, I say, shaking my head.
You sure are,
he tells me, laughing, and then pulls down his mask again. I am left grinning after him as he sweeps away into the crowd. Just seeing him has filled me with a sense of finally belonging to this place. He and the ghost and the bomb are not precisely my friends, but they actually seem to like me, and I am not inclined to split hairs. I have a place with them and a purpose.
Where have you been?
Vivienne asks, grabbing hold of me.
You need a leash like Oaks. Come on, we're going to dance.
I eddy along with them. There's music everywhere, urging a lightness of step. They say the pull of fairy music is impossible to resist, which isn't quite true. What's impossible is to stop dancing once you've begun, so long as the music goes on. And it does. All night. One dance bleeding into the next. One song becoming another, without a pause to catch your breath. It's exhilarating to be caught up in the music, to be swept away in the tide of it. Of course, Vivi, being one of them, can stop whenever she wants. She can also yank us out, so dancing with her is almost safe. Not that Vivi always remembers to do the safe thing. But really, I am the last person to judge anyone for that. We clasp hands and join the circle dance, leaping and laughing. The song feels as though it is calling my blood, moving it through my veins to the same ragged beat, with the same sweet chords. The circle breaks up, and somehow I am holding Locke's hands. He sweeps me around in a giddy whoosh.
You are beautiful, he says, like a winter night.
He smiles down at me with his fox eyes. His russet hair curls around his pointed ears. From one lobe, a golden earring dangles, catching the candlelight like a mirror. He's the one who's beautiful. A kind of breathless, inhuman beauty. I'm glad you like the dress, I manage.
Tell me, could you love me?
He asks, seemingly out of nowhere. Of course. I laugh, not sure of the answer I'm supposed to give. But the question is so oddly phrased that I can hardly deny him. I love my parents' murderer. I suppose I could love anyone. I'd like to love him.
I wonder, he says, what would you do for me?
I don't know what you mean. This riddling figure with flinty eyes isn't the lock who stood on the rooftop of his estate and spoke so gently to me, or who chased me, laughing through its halls. I am not quite sure who this lock is, but he has put me entirely off balance.
Would you forswear a promise for me?
He is smiling at me as though he's teasing. What promise? He sweeps me around him, my leather slippers pirouetting over the packed earth. In the distance, a piper begins to play.
Any promise,
he says lightly, although it is no light thing he is asking. I guess it depends, I say, because the real answer, a flat no, isn't what anyone wants to hear.
Do you love me enough to give me up?
I am sure my expression is stricken. He leans closer.
Isn't that a test of love?
I don't know, I say. All this must be leading up to some declaration on his part, either of affection or of a lack of it.
Do you love me enough to weep over me?
The words are spoken against my neck. I can feel his breath, making the tiny hairs stand up, making me shudder with an odd combination of desire and discomfort.
You mean if you were hurt? I mean, if I hurt you.
My skin prickles. I don't like this, but at least I know what to say. If you hurt me, I wouldn't cry. I would hurt you back. His step falters as we sweep over the floor.
I'm sure you'd.
And then he breaks off speaking, looking behind him. I can barely think. My face is hot. I dread what he will say next.
Time to change partners,
a voice says. And I look to see that it's the worst person possible. Cardin.
Oh,
he says to Locke.
Did I steal your line?
His tone is unfriendly, and as I turn his words over in my mind, they do little to comfort me. Locke relinquishes me to the youngest prince, as is expected out of deference. I see out of the corner of my eye that Taryn is watching us. She's standing frozen in the middle of the revel, looking lost, as fairies swarm around her, swinging their partners in dizzying spirals. I wonder if Cardin bothered her before he bothered me. He takes my wounded hand in his. He's wearing black gloves, the leather warm even through the silk over my fingers, and a black suit of clothes. Raven feathers cover the upper half of his doublet, and his boots have excessively pointed metal toes that make me conscious of how easy it will be to kick me savagely once we've begun dancing. At his brow, he wears a crown of woven metal branches, cocked slightly askew. Dark silver paint streaks over his cheekbones, and black lines run along his lashes. The left one is smeared, as though he forgot about it and wiped his eye. "What do you want?" I ask him, forcing the words out. I am still thinking about Locke, still reeling from what he said and what he didn't. Go ahead, insult me. His eyebrows go up.
I don't take commands from mortals,
he says, with his customary cruel smile. So you're going to say something nice?
I don't think so. Fairies can't lie.
I want to be angry, but what I feel right now is gratitude. My face is no longer flaming, and my eyes aren't stinging. I'm ready to fight, which is far better, though I am sure it's the last thing he meant. He did me an enormous favor when he whisked me away from Locke.
His hand slides lower on my hip. I narrow my eyes at him.
You really hate me, don't you?
He asks, his smile growing. Almost as much as you hate me, I say, thinking of the page with my name scratched on it. Thinking of the way he looked at me when he was drunk in the hedge maze. The way he's looking at me now. He lets go of my hand.
Until we spar again,
he says, making a bow that I cannot help feel is nothing but mockery. I look after him as he weaves unsteadily through the crowd, not sure what to make of that conversation. Bells begin to ring, signaling the start of the ceremony. The musicians quiet their fiddles and harps. For a long moment, the hill is silent, listening, and then people move to their places. I push toward the front, where the rest of the gentry of the High King's Court are assembling, where my family will be. Oriana is there already, standing beside one of Maddox's best knights and looking as though she wishes she could be anywhere else. Oak is off his leash and on Taryn's shoulders. She is whispering something to a laughing Locke. I stop moving. The crowd surges around me, but I am rooted to the spot as Taryn leans in and tucks a stray bit of hair behind Locke's ear. There is so much in that small gesture. I try to make myself believe it means nothing, but after the strange conversation we had, I can't. But Taryn has a lover, one who is going to ask for her hand tonight. And she knows that Locke and I are whatever we are. Do you love me enough to give me up? Isn't that a test of love? Vivienne has come out of the crowd, cat eyes agleam, hair loose around her face. She takes Oak in her arms and swings him around and around until they both fall in a whoosh of Vivi's skirts. I should go over, but I don't. I can't face Taryn yet. Not when I cannot get such a disloyal thought out of my head. Instead, I hang back, watching the royal family assemble on the dais. The High King is seated on his throne of woven branches, wearing the heavy circlet, looking out from his deeply lined face with alert bronze eyes, like those of an owl. Prince Dane sits on a humble wooden stool beside him, dressed in all white robes, his feet and hands bare, and behind the throne stands the rest of the royal family, Bailkin and Elowyn, Raya and Kalia. Even Taniat, Prince Dane's mother, is present, in a garment of shining gold. The only family member missing is Cardin. The High King Eldred stands, and the entire hill goes quiet.
Long has been my rule, but today I take my leave of you.
His voice echoes through the hill. Rarely has he ever spoken this way, to a great assemblage of us, and I am struck both by the power of his voice and the frailness of his person.
When first I felt the call to search out the land of promise, I believed it would pass, but I can resist it no longer. Today, I will be king no more, but wanderer.
Although everyone here must know this was what we've gathered for, still there are cries from all around me. A sprite begins to weep into the hair of a goat-headed Fuka. The court poet and seneschal, Val Morin, steps from the side of the dais. He is stooped, spindly, his long hair full of sticks, with a scold crow perched on one shoulder. He leans heavily on a staff of smooth wood that has begun to bud at the very top, as though it were still alive.
He is rumored to have been lured away from the mortal land to Eldred's bed in his youth. I wonder what he will do now, without his king.
"We are loath to let you go, my lord,"
he says, and the words seem to take on a special, bittersweet resonance coming from his mouth. Eldred cups his hands, and the branches of the throne shudder and begin to grow, sending up new green shoots to spiral into the air, leaves unfurling and flower buds bursting along the length of them. The roots of the ceiling begin to worm, lengthening like vines and crawling across the underside of the hill. There is a scent in the air, like a summer breeze, heavy with the promise of apples.
"Another will stand in my place. I ask of you, release me."
The assembled folk speak as one, surprising me.
"We release you,"
they say, words echoing around me. The High King lets his heavy robe of state fall from his shoulders. It crumples on the stone in a jewel-encrusted pile. He takes the oak-leaf crown from his own head. Already, he stands up straighter. There is an unnerving eagerness in him. Eldred has been the High King of Elfheim longer than the memories of many of the folk. He has always seemed ancient to me, but the years seem to fall from him, along with the mantle of rule.
"Whom will you put in your stead to be our High King?"
Valmorin asks.
"My third-born, my son, Dane," says Eldred. "Come forward, child."
Prince Dane rises from his humble place on the stool. His mother removes the white cloth covering him, leaving him naked. I blink once. I am used to a certain amount of nakedness in Faerie, but not among the royal family. Standing next to the rest of them in their heavy brocade and embroidered magnificence, he looks exquisitely vulnerable. I wonder if he's cold. I think of my hurt hand, and hope so.
"Will you accept?"
Valmorin asks. The scald crow on his shoulder lifts black-tipped wings and beats the air. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be part of the ceremony.
"I will assume the burden and the honor of the crown,"
Dane says gravely. And in that moment, his nakedness becomes something else. Some sign of power.
"I will have it. Unseely court, knight host, come forward and anoint your prince,"
Valmorin says. A bogan makes her hulking way to the raised dais. Her body is covered in thick golden hair, her arms long enough to drag on the ground if she didn't bend them. She looks strong enough to break Prince Dane in half. Around her waist, she wears a skirt of patchwork furs, and in one massive hand, she carries what looks like an inkpot. She paints his left arm with long spirals of clotting blood, paints it over his stomach, down his left leg. He does not flinch. When she is done, she steps back to admire her grisly handiwork, and then gives a shallow bow to Eldred.
"Seelie Court, twilight folk, come forward and anoint your prince,"
Valmorin says. A diminutive boy in a wrapper of what looks like birch bark, his wild hair sticking up at odd angles, walks to the dais. Small, pale green wings sit on his back. When he anoints Dane's other side, he paints it in thick swaths of pollen, yellow as butter.
"Wild fae, shy folk, come forward and anoint your prince,"
says Valmorin. It is a hob who comes forward this time, in a dapper little suit, carefully sewn. He carries with him a handful of mud, which he smears over the center of Prince Dane's chest, just above his heart. I finally spot Cardan in the crowd, unsteady on his feet and with a wineskin in one hand. He appears to have gotten himself riotously drunk. When I think of the smear of silver paint on his face and the way his hand had slid on my hip, I guess he was well on his way there when I saw him. I feel an immense, mean satisfaction that he is not standing with the royal family at the most important moment for the court in centuries.
He's going to be in so much trouble.
Who will clothe him?
Valmorin asks. And in turn, each of his sisters, and then his mother, bring him a white tunic and pants made from hide, a collar of gold, and high kidskin boots.
He looks like a storybook king,
one who will have a wise and just rule. I imagine the ghost in the rafters, and the roach in his mask watching proudly. I feel some of that same pride, being sworn to him. But I cannot forget his words to me. You are my creature, Jude Duarte. I touch my wounded hand to the hilt of my silver sword, the sword my father forged. After tonight, I will be the High King's spy and a true member of his court. I will lie to his enemies and, if that doesn't work, I will find a way to do something worse. And if he crosses me, well, then I will find a way around that too. Valmorin brings the end of his staff down hard against the ground, and I feel the reverberation to my teeth.
And who will crown him?
Eldred wears an expression of pride. The crown gleams in his gnarled hands, glowing as if sunlight emanated from the metal itself.
I will.
The guards are changing configuration subtly, perhaps preparing to escort Eldred out of the palace. There are more knights at the edges of the crowd than there were when the coronation ceremony began. The High King speaks.
Come, Dane. Kneel before me.
The Crown Prince bends down in front of his father and the assemblage. My gaze cuts to Taryn, who is still standing with Locke. Orianna has a protective arm around Oak, one of Maddox's lieutenants bending to speak with her. He gestures toward a doorway, and she says something to Vivi and then starts toward it. Taryn and Locke follow. I grit my teeth and start to push my way through the crowd to them. I don't want to disgrace myself like Cardin by not being where I'm supposed to be. Valmorin's voice cuts through my thoughts.
And will you, the folk of Elfheim, accept Prince Dane as your High King?
The cry rose up from the crowd in chirping voices and bellows. We will! My gaze goes to the night surrounding the dais. In another life, I would have been one of them. But as my eyes rest there, I notice familiar faces. Maddox's best commanders. Warriors who are fiercely loyal. They are not dressed in their uniforms. Over shining armor, they wear the greenbrier livery. Perhaps Maddox is only being careful. Only putting his best people in place. But the spy I killed, the one with the taunting message, was Maddox as well. And Orianna, Oak, and my sisters are gone, escorted out of the hill by one of Maddox's lieutenants just as the dais became more heavily guarded. I have a plan to ensure our futures. I need to find the roach. I need to find the ghost. I need to tell them that something's wrong. A well-seasoned strategist waits for the right opportunity. I push past a trio of goblins and a troll and one of the still folk. A Spriggan growls at me, but I don't pay any mind. The end of the coronation is in sight. I see goblets and tankards being refilled. Up on the dais, Baelkin has left his place with the other princes and princesses. For a moment, I think it's part of the ceremony. Until he draws a long, thin blade. One I recognize from his horrible duel with Cardin. I stop moving.
Brother,
Prince Dane admonishes.
I will not accept you,
Baelkin says.
I have come to challenge you for the crown.
All around the dais, I see knights unsheathing blades. But neither Elowyn nor Eldred, nor any of the rest of them, not Valmorin, nor Taniot, nor Rhaya, is equipped. Only Kalia pulls out a knife from her bodice, the blade too small to be of much use.
I want to draw my own sword, but everyone is pressed in too tightly.
Belkin,
Eldred says sternly.
Child, the High Court cannot be like the lower courts. We have no blood inheritance. No duel with your brother will induce me to place a crown on your unworthy head. Content yourself with my choice. Do not humiliate yourself before all of Faerie.
This ought only be between us,
Belkin says to Dane, not acknowledging that his father had even spoken.
There is no High Monarch now. There is no one but us and a crown.
I need not fight you,
Dane says, gesturing out toward the knights grouped thickly around the dais, waiting for an order. Madoc is among them, but I am not close enough to see more than that.
And you are not worthy of even that much regard.
Then have this on your conscience.
Belkin walks two steps and thrusts out his arm. He doesn't even look in the direction he's thrusting, but his blade pierces Elowyn's throat. Someone shrieks. Then everyone does. For a moment, the wound is just a blotch against her skin, and then blood pours out, a river of red. She staggers forward, going to her hands and knees. Gold fabric and glittering gems are drowning in scarlet. It was a mere flick of Belkin's blade, an almost nonchalant gesture. Eldred's hand comes up. I think he means to conjure up the same magic that made the roots grow, made the branches of the throne bloom and twine. But that power is gone. He gave it up with his kingdom. Instead, the newly budded flowers of the throne brown and wither. The crow on Valmorin's shoulder takes to wing, cawing as it flies toward the roots hanging down from the hollow roof of the hill.
Guards,
Dane says, in a voice that expects to be obeyed. None of the knights advance toward the dais, though. As one, they turn, so their backs are to the royal family, and their swords to the assemblage. They're allowing this to happen, allowing Belkin to stage his coup. But I cannot believe that this is in Madoc's plan. Dane is his friend. Dane campaigned with him. Dane is going to reward him once he's the High King. The crowd surges, carrying me with it. Everyone is moving, pushing forward or away from the gruesome tableau. I see the salt-haired king of the Court of Termites try to wade toward the fight. But his own knights get in front of him, holding him back. My family is gone. I look around for Cardan, but he is lost in the crowd. It is all happening so fast. Kalia has run to the High King's side. She has her small knife, barely long enough to be a weapon, but she holds it bravely. Taniot crouches over Elowyn's body, trying to stem the tide of blood with the skirts of her dress.
What do you say now, father?
Belkin demands.
Brother?
Two bolts fly from the shadows, thudding into Belkin's side. He staggers forward. The cloth of his doublet appears ripped, a gleam of metal underneath. Armor. I scan the rafters for the ghost. I am an agent of the prince as surely as he is. It's my duty to get to Dane. I shove forward again. In my head, I can see a vision of the future. Like a story I am telling myself. A clear, shining narrative to contrast with the chaos around me. Somehow, I will get to the prince and defend him against Belkin's treachery until the loyal members of his guard reach us. I will be the hero, the one who put herself between the traitors and her king. Madoc gets there before I do. For a brief moment, I am relieved. His commander's loyalty might be bought, but Madoc would never. Then Madoc thrusts his sword through Dane's chest with such force that the blade emerges on the other side. He drags it up through his rib cage to his heart. I stop moving and let the crowd flow around me.
I am still as stone. I see a flash of white bone, of wet red muscle. Prince Dane, who was almost the High King, falls on top of the gem-crusted red cloak of state, his spilling blood lost in the jumble of jewels.
Traitors,
Eldred whispers, but his voice is amplified by the space. The word feels as though it rings through the hall. Madoc pauses and then sets his jaw, as though he is doing some grim duty. He is wearing his red cap now, the one I saw sticking out of his pocket, the one I have studied in its case. Tonight, he will freshen it. There will be new tied lines. But I cannot believe he is doing this on anyone's orders. He must have allied with Baelkin, misdirected Dane's spies, put his own commanders in place to keep the royal family isolated from anyone who would help them, urged Baelkin to orchestrate a strike at the one time no one would expect it, even figured out that the only way not to trigger the crown's death curse was to move when it rested on no one's head. Knowing him as I do, I am sure he planned this coup. Madoc has betrayed Eldred, and Dane is gone, taking all my hopes and plans with him. Coronations are a time when many things are possible. Baelkin looks insufferably satisfied with himself.
Give me the crown.
Eldred drops the circlet from his hand. It rolls a little ways across the floor.
Take it yourself, if it's what you so desire.
Kalia is making a terrible keening sound. Raya stares at the crowd in horror. Valmorin stands beside Eldred, his narrow poet's face pale. With the night circling it, the dais is like a terrible stage, where all the players are doomed to run through their roles to the same bloody end. Madoc's hands are gloved in red. I cannot stop staring at them. Baelkin lifts the high crown. The golden oak leaves glitter with the light of candle flame.
You waited too long to depart the throne, father.
You have become weak. You let traitors rule little fiefdoms. The power of the low courts goes unchecked, and the wild fae do as they like. Dane would have been the same, a coward who hid behind intrigues. But I am not afraid of bloodshed.
Eldred does not speak. He makes no move toward the crown or toward a weapon. He simply waits. Baelkin orders a knight to bring him Taniot. A female redcap in armor steps onto the dais to grab the struggling consort. Taniot's head lashes back and forth, her long black horns cutting into the redcap knight's shoulder. It doesn't matter. None of it matters. There are too many knights. Two more step forward, and there is no more struggling. Baelkin draws himself up before his father.
Declare me the High King. Put the crown on my head, and you may go from this place, free and unharmed. My sisters will be protected. Your consort will live. Otherwise, I will kill Taniot. I will kill her here in front of everyone, and they will all know that you allowed it.
My gaze goes to Madoc, but he is on the steps, speaking in low tones to one of his commanders, a troll who has eaten at our table, has teased Oak and made him laugh. I laughed too then. Now my hands are shaking, my whole body trembling.
Baelkin, firstborn, no matter whose blood you spill, you will never rule Alfheim,
Eldred says.
You are unworthy of the crown.
I close my eyes and think of Orianna's words to me. It is no easy thing to be the lover of the High King. it is to always be a pawn. Taniot goes to her death with grace. She is still. Her bearing is regal and doomed, as though she has already passed into the realm of ballads. Her fingers are laced together. She makes no sound as one of the knights, the red-cap knight with the slashed shoulder, beheads her with a single, swift, and brutal strike of her blade. Taniot's horned head rolls a short ways until it hits Dane's corpse. I feel something wet on my face, like rain. There are plenty of folk who delight in murder, and plenty more who delight in spectacle. A kind of giddy madness seems to come upon the crowd. A kind of hunger for even greater slaughter. I fear they may have a surfeit of satisfaction. Two of the knights have seized Eldred.
I will not ask you again,
Bilkin says. But Eldred only laughs. He keeps laughing when Bailkin runs him through. He doesn't fall like the others. Instead of blood pouring from his wound, red moths stream out into the air. They rush out of him so quickly that in a moment, the High King's body is gone, and there are just red moths swirling up into the air in a vast cloud, a tornado of soft wings. But whatever magic made them does not last. They begin to fall until they are scattered across the dais like blown leaves. The High King Eldred is, impossibly, dead. The dais is strewn with bodies and blood. Valmorin is on his knees.
Sisters,
Bilkin says, striding toward them. Some of the arrogance is gone from his voice, replaced with a horrible softness. He sounds like a man in the midst of a terrible dream from which he refuses to wake.
Which of you will crown me?
Crown me and live. I think of Madoc telling my mother not to run. Kalia steps forward, dropping her knife. She is dressed in a stomacher of gold and a skirt of blue, a circlet of berries in her loose hair. I will do it, she says. It is enough. I will make you the High King, although the stain of what you have done will forever taint your rule. Never is like forever, I think. And then I'm angry to be reminded of anything Cardin has ever said, especially now. There's a part of me that is glad she has given in, despite the awfulness of Bilkin, the inevitable horror of his rule. At least this is over. A bolt comes from the shadows of the rafters, in a completely different trajectory than the last. It strikes her in the chest. Her eyes go wide. Her hands flutter over her heart, as though the wound is immodest and she needs to cover it. Then her eyes roll back, and she goes down without a sigh. It is Bailkin who cries out with frustration. Madoc gives orders to his men, pointing toward the ceiling. A phalanx breaks off from the others and rushes up the stairs. A few guards fly up into the air on pale green wings, blades drawn. He killed her. The ghost killed her. I push my way blindly toward the dais, past Aslua, howling for more blood. I don't know what I think I am going to do when I get there. Rhea picks up her sister's knife, holds it in one shaking hand. Her blue dress makes her look like a bird, caught before she could take flight. She's Vivi's only real friend in Faerie.
Are you really going to fight me, sister?
Bilkin says.
You have neither sword nor armor. Come, it is too late for that.
It is too late, she says, and brings the knife to her own throat, pressing the point just below her ear. No, I shout, although my voice is drowned out by the crowd, drowned out by Bailkin shouting too. And then, because I can't stand to see any more death, I close my eyes. I keep them closed through being jostled by something heavy and furred. Baelkin starts calling for someone to find Cardin, to bring him Cardin. And my eyes automatically fly open. But there's no Cardin in sight. Only Raya's crumpled body, and more horror. Winged archers take aim at the cluster of roots where the ghost was hiding. A moment later, he drops down into the crowd. I hold my breath, afraid he has been hit. But he rolls, stands, and takes off up the stairs, with guards hot on his heels. He has no chance. There are too many of them. And the Breck is too packed, leaving nowhere to run. I want to help him. Want to go to him. But I am hemmed in. I can do nothing. I can save no one. Baelkin turns on the court poet, pointing at him.
You will crown me. Speak the words of the ceremony.
I cannot, Valmorin says. I am no kin to you. No kin to the crown.
You will,
Baelkin says.
Yes, my liege.
The court poet answers in a quavering voice. He stumbles through a quick version of the coronation as the hill goes silent. But when the crowd is asked to accept Baelkin as the new High King, no one speaks. The golden oakleaf crown is in Baelkin's hand, but not yet on his head. Baelkin's gaze sweeps over the audience, and though I know it will not settle on me, I still flinch. His voice booms.
Pledge yourselves to me!
We do not. The monarchs do not bend their knees. The gentry are silent. The wild fairies watch and measure. I see Queen Annet, of the southmost Unseelie court, the court of moths, signal to her courtiers to leave the hall. She turns away with a sneer.
You are sworn to the High King,
Baelkin booms.
And I am king now.
Baelkin lifts the crown and sets it on his own head. But a moment later, he howls, knocking it off. A burn is on his brow. The red shadow of a circlet.
We do not swear to the king, but to the crown,
someone cries. It is Lord Roybin of the Court of Termites. He has made his way to stand in front of the knights. And although there are more than a dozen directly between him and Baelkin, Roybin does not seem particularly concerned.
You have 3 days to get it onto your head, Kinslayer. 3 days before I will depart here, unsworn, unchecked in power, and unimpressed. And I am certain not to be the only one.
There is a smattering of laughter and whispers as his words spread. A motley group still fills the hall, glittering Seelie and terrifying Unseelie. The wild fae that seldom leave their hills, rivers, or grave mounds. Goblins and hags, pixies and fukas. They have watched nearly all the royal family be slaughtered in a single night. I wonder how much more violence will spring up if there is no new monarch to caution them. I wonder who would welcome it. Sprites glitter in the air that stinks of freshly spilled blood. The revel will go on, I realize. Everything will go on. But I am not sure that I can. Book 2. Empty your heart of its mortal dream. The winds awaken, the leaves whirl round. Our cheeks are pale, our hair is unbound. Our breasts are heaving, our eyes agleam. Our arms are waving, our lips are apart. And if any gaze on our rushing band, we come between him and the deed of his hand. We come between him and the hope of his heart. William Butler Yeats, The Hosting of the She. Chapter 21. I am a child again, hiding under a table, with the revel spinning around above me.
Pressing my hand to my heart, I feel the speeding thud of it. I cannot think. I cannot think. I cannot think. There is blood on my dress. Little dots of it sinking into the blue sky. I thought I could not be shocked by death. But there was just so much of it. An embarrassing, ridiculous excess. My mind keeps going back over Prince Dane's white ribs, the spray of blood from Elowen's throat, and the High King's denying Baelkin over and over as he died. Over poor Taniot and Kalia and Rhaya, who were forced to discover each in turn how the Crown of Faerie mattered more than their lives. I think of Matic, who had been at Dane's right hand all these years. Faeries might not be able to lie outright, but Matic had lied with every laugh, every clap on the back, every shared cup of wine. Matic, who'd let us all get dressed up and given me a beautiful sword to wear tonight, as though we were really going to some fun party. I knew what he was, I tried to tell myself. I saw the blood crusted on his red cap. If I let myself forget, then more fool me. At least knights had led my family away before the killing started. At least none of the others had to watch. Although, unless they were very far away, they could not have failed to hear the screams. At least Oak would not grow up as I have, with death as my birthright. I sit there until my heart slows again. I need to get out of the hill. This revel is going to turn wilder, and with no new High Monarch on the throne, there is little holding any of the revelers back from any entertainment they can devise. It's probably not the best time to be immortal here. I try to remember looking down on the layout of the throne room from above with the ghost. I try to recall the entrances into the main part of the castle. If I could find one of the guards and make them believe that I was part of Maddox's household, they might take me to the rest of my family. But I don't want to go. I don't want to see Matic, covered in blood, sitting beside Baelkin. I don't want to pretend that what happened is anything other than horrific. I don't want to disguise my disgust. There's another way out. I can crawl under the tables to the steps and go up them to the ledge near Matic's strategy room. I think from there I can climb directly through and be in the part of the castle most likely to be deserted. And the part with access to secret tunnels. From there, I can get out without worrying about knights or guards or anyone else. Adrenaline makes my whole body sing with the desire to move, but although what I have feels like a plan, it's not one yet. I can get out of the palace, but I have nowhere to go after that. Figure it out later, instinct urges. Okay, half a plan is good enough. On my hands and knees, heedless of my dress, heedless of the way the sheath of my sword drags against the packed earth floor, heedless of the pain in my hand, I crawl. Above me I hear music. I hear other things too. The snap of what might be bones. A whimper. A howl. I ignore all of it. Then the tablecloth lifts, and as my eyes adjust to the brightness of the candlelight, a masked figure grabs for my arm. There's no easy way to draw my sword, crouched as I am under a table, so I grab for the knife inside my bodice. I am about to strike when I recognize those ridiculous spike-tipped shoes. Cardin, the only one who can legitimately crown Baelkin, the only other descendant of the Greenbriar line left. Everyone in Faerie must be looking for him. And here he is, wandering around in a flimsy silver fox half-mask, blinking at me with drunken confusion and swaying a bit on his feet. I almost laugh outright. Imagine my luck to be the one to find him.
You're mortal,
he informs me. In his other hand, he's carrying an empty goblet, tipped over absently, as though he's forgotten he still carries it.
It's not safe for you here, especially if you go around stabbing everyone.
Not safe for me? Absurdity of the statement aside, I have no idea why he's acting as though he's ever thought about my safety for a moment, except to endanger it. I try to remind myself he must be in shock and grieving, and that might make him behave strangely. But it's hard to think of him as a person who could care about anyone enough to mourn. Right now, he doesn't even seem to care about himself. Get down here before you're recognized.
Playing hide and seek under the table? Crouching in the dirt? Typical of your kind, but far beneath my dignity.
He laughs unsteadily, like he expects I'm going to laugh too. I don't. I ball up my fist and punch him in the stomach, right where I know it will hurt. He staggers to his knees. The goblet drops to the dirt, making a hollow clanking sound.
Ow!
He shouts, and lets me tug him under the table. We'll get out of here without anyone noticing, I tell him. We stay under the tables and make our way to the steps to the upper levels of the palace. And don't tell me it's beneath your dignity to crawl. You're so drunk, you can barely stand anyway. I hear him snort.
If you insist,
he says. It's too dark to see his expression, and even if it wasn't, he's masked. We make our way through the underside of the tables, with ballads and drinking songs sung above us, screams and whispers in the air, and the soft footfalls of dancers echoing around us like rain. My heart is hammering from the bloodshed, from Cardin being so close, from striking him without consequences. I concentrate on him shuffling behind me. Everything smells of packed earth, spilled wine, and blood. I can feel my thoughts spiraling away, can feel myself start to tremble. I bite the inside of my lip to give myself a fresh pain to focus on. I must keep it together. I can't lose it now, not where Cardin will see. And not when a plan is starting to form in my mind. A plan requiring this last prince. I glance back and see that he has stopped moving. He's sitting on the ground, looking at his hand, looking at his ring.
He despised me.
His voice sounds light, conversational. Like he's forgotten where he is. Baelkin? I ask, thinking of what I saw at Hollow Hall.
My father,
Cardin snorts.
I didn't much know the others, my brothers and sisters. Isn't that funny? Prince Dane. He didn't want me in the palace, so he forced me out.
I wait, not sure what to say. It's disturbing to see him like this, behaving as though he might have emotions. After a moment, he seems to come back to himself. His eyes focus on me, glittering in the dark.
And now they're all dead. Thanks to Matic, our honorable general. They never should have trusted him. But your mother discovered that a long time ago, didn't she?
I narrow my eyes. Crawl. The corner of his mouth lifts.
You first.
We go from table to table, until finally we're as close as we're likely to get to the steps. Cardin pushes back the tablecloth and reaches out his hand toward me, in the gallant manner of someone helping up the person they've been trysting with. Maybe Cardin would say he was doing it for the benefit of onlookers. But we both know he's mocking me. I stand without touching him. The only thing that matters is getting out of the hall before the revel gets bloodier, before the wrong creature decides I'm an amusing plaything, before Cardin is gutted by someone who doesn't want any high monarch in power. I start toward the steps, but he stops me.
Not like that. Your father's knights will recognize you.
I'm not the one they're looking for, I remind him. He frowns, although his mask hides most of it,
Still, I can see it in the turn of his mouth.
If they see your face, they may pay too much attention to whom you're with.
Annoyingly, he's right. If they knew me at all, they'd know I'd never be with you. Which is ridiculous, since I am currently standing beside him. Although it makes me feel better to say it. With a sigh, I take down my braids, rubbing my hands through my hair until it hangs wild in my face.
You look,
he says, and then trails off, blinking a few times, not seeming able to finish. I am guessing the hair thing worked better than he had expected. Give me a second, I say, and I plunge into the crowd. I don't like risking this, but covering my face is safer than not. I spot a Nixie in a black velvet mask eating a tiny sparrow's heart off a long pin. Sly footing up behind her, I cut the ribbons and catch the mask before it hits the floor. She turns, searching for where it fell. But I am already away. Soon she will abandon looking and eat another delicacy. Or at least I hope she will. It is just a mask, after all. When I return, Cardin is swilling down more wine. His gaze burning into me. I have no idea what he sees, what he's even looking for. A thin rivulet of green liquid pours over his cheek. He reaches for the heavy silver pitcher, as if to pour himself another cup. Come on, I say, grabbing for his gloved hand with mine. We're to the steps out of the hall when three knights move to block our way.
Look elsewhere for your pleasure,
one informs us.
This is the way to the palace, and it is barred to common folk.
I feel Cardin stiffen beside me, because he's an idiot and cares more about being called common than anyone's safety, sadly even his own. I tug his arm.
We will do as we are bid, I assure the knight, trying to move Cardin away before he does something we will both regret.
Cardin, however, will not be moved.
You are much mistaken in us.
Shut up, shut up, shut up!
The High King Bilkin is a friend to my lady's court,
Cardin says, silver-tongued in his silver fox mask. He wears an easy half-smile. He's speaking the language of privilege, speaking it with his drawling tone, with the looseness of his limbs, as though he thinks he owns everything he can see. Even drunk, he's convincing.
You may have heard of Queen Glitten in the northwest. Bilkin sent a message about the missing prince. He is waiting for an answer.
I don't suppose you have any proof of that,
one of the knights asks.
Of course.
Cardin holds out a fisted hand and opens it to reveal a royal ring gleaming in the center of his palm. I have no idea when he took it off his finger. A neat bit of sleight of hand that I had no idea he could do, no less while inebriated.
I was given this token so you would know me.
At the sight of the ring, they step back. With an obnoxious, too charming smile, Cardin grabs my arm and hauls me past them. Although I have to grit my teeth, I let him. We're on the steps, and it's because of him.
What about the mortal?
One of the guards calls. Cardin turns.
Oh, well, you aren't entirely mistaken in me. I intended to keep some of the delights of the revel for myself,
he says, and they all smirk. It is all I can do not to knock him to the ground, but there's no dispute, he's clever with words. According to the Baroque rules that govern Fey tongues, everything he said was true enough. So long as you concentrate only on the words. Bilkin is Maddox's friend, and I am part of Maddox's court. If you squint a little. So I am the lady. And the knights probably have heard of Queen Glitten. She's famous enough. And sure, Bilkin is waiting for an answer about the missing prince. He's probably desperate for one. And no one can claim that Cardin's ring isn't meant to be a token by which he's known. As for what he wants to keep from the revel, it could be anything. Cardin is clever,
But it's not a nice kind of cleverness. And it's a little too close to my own propensity for lying to be comfortable. Still, we're free. Behind us, what should have been a celebration of a new High King continues. The shrieking, the feasting, the whirling around in endless looping dances. I glance back once as we climb, taking in the sea of bodies and wings, ink-drop eyes and sharp teeth. I shudder. We climb the steps together. I let him keep his possessive grip on my arm, guiding me. I let him open the doors with his own keys. I let him do whatever he wants. And then, once we're in the empty hall in the upper level of the palace, I turn and press the point of my knife directly underneath his chin.
Jude?
He asks, up against the wall, pronouncing my name carefully, as though to avoid slurring. I'm not sure I have ever heard him use my actual name before. Surprised? I ask, a fierce grin starting on my face. The most important boy in Faerie, and my enemy, finally in my power. It feels even better than I thought it would. You shouldn't be. Chapter 22. I press the tip of the knife against his skin so he can feel the bite. His black eyes focus on me with new intensity.
Why?
He asks. Just that. Seldom have I felt such a rush of triumph. I have to concentrate on keeping it from going to my head. Stronger than wine. Because your luck is terrible, and mine is great. Do what I say, and I'll delay the pleasure of hurting you.
Planning to spill a little more royal blood tonight?
He sneers, moving as if to shrug off the knife. I move with him, keeping it against his throat. He keeps talking.
Feeling left out at the slaughter?
You're drunk, I say.
Oh, indeed.
He leans his head back against the stone, closing his eyes. Nearby torchlight turns his black hair to bronze.
But do you really believe I am going to let you parade me in front of the general, as though I am some lowly...
I press the knife harder. He sucks in a breath and bites off the end of that sentence.
Of course,
he says a moment later, with a laugh full of self-mockery.
I was passed out cold while my family was murdered. It's hard to fall more lowly than that.
Stop talking, I tell him, pushing aside any twinge of sympathy. He never had any for me. Move.
Or what?
He asks, still not opening his eyes.
You're not really going to stab me. When was the last time you saw your dear friend, Valerian?
I whisper. Not today, despite the insult implied by his absence. Did you wonder at that? His eyes open. He looks as though I slapped him awake.
I did. Where is he?
Rotting near Maddox Stables. I killed him. And then I buried him. So believe me when I threaten you. No matter how unlikely it seems, you are the most important person in all of Faerie. Whosoever has you has power. And I want power.
I suppose you were right after all.
He studies my face, giving nothing away on his own.
I suppose I didn't know the least of what you could do.
I try not to let him know how much his calmness rattles me. It makes me feel as though the knife in my hand, which should lend me authority, isn't enough. It makes me want to hurt him just to convince myself he can be frightened. He's just lost his whole family. I shouldn't be thinking like this. But I can't help thinking that he will exploit any pity on my part, any weakness. Time to move, I say harshly. Go to the first door and open it. When we're inside, we're going to the closet. There's a passageway through there.
Yes. Fine,
he says, annoyed, trying to push my blade away. I hold it steady, so that the knife cuts into his skin. He swears and puts a bleeding finger in his mouth.
What was that for?
For fun, I say, and then ease the blade from his throat. Slowly and deliberately. My lip curls, but otherwise I keep my expression as mask-like as I know how. As cruel and cold as the face that reoccurs in my nightmares. It is only as I do it that I realize who I am aping. Whose face frightened me into wanting it for my own. His. My heart is hammering so hard, I feel sick.
Will you at least tell me where we're going?
He asks as I shove him ahead of me with my free hand.
No. Now move.
The growl in my voice is all mine. Unbelievably, he does, swaying as he makes his way down the hall and then into the study I indicate. When we get to the hidden passageway, he crawls in with only a single inscrutable glance back at me. Maybe he's even drunker than I thought. It doesn't matter. He'll sober up soon enough. The first thing I do when I get to the nest of the Court of Shadows is tie Prince Cardin to a chair with shredded pieces of my own dirty dress. Then I remove both of our masks. He lets me do it all, an odd look on his face. No one else is there, and I have no idea when anyone might come back, if they will at all. It doesn't matter. I can manage without them. I have made it this far, after all. When Cardin found me, I knew that having control of him was the only path to having some control over the fate of my world. I think of all the vows I made to Dane, including the one I never spoke out loud. Instead of being afraid, I will become something to fear. If Dane isn't going to give me power, then I am going to take it for myself. Not having spent much time in the Court of Shadows, I don't know its secrets. I walk through rooms, opening heavy wooden doors, opening cabinets, taking inventory of my supplies. I discover a pantry that is as full of poisons as it is of cheeses and sausages. A training room with sawdust on the floor, weapons on the wall, and a new wooden dummy in the center. Its face crudely painted with a disturbing grin. I go into the back room with four pallets on the ground and a few mugs and discarded clothing spread out near them. I touch none of it, until I come to the map room with a desk. Dane's desk, stuffed with scrolls and pens and sealing wax. For a moment, I am overwhelmed by the enormity of what has happened. Prince Dane is gone. Gone forever. And his father and sisters are gone with him. I go back to the main room and drag Cardin and the chair into Dane's office, propping it against the open door so I can keep an eye on him. I take down a handheld crossbow from the wall in the training room, along with a few bolts. Weapon beside me, cocked and ready. I sit down in Dane's chair and rest my head in my hands.
Will you tell me where exactly we are, now that I'm trussed up to your satisfaction?
I want to strike Cardin over and over until I slapped that smugness off his face. But if I did, he'd know just how much he scares me. This is where Prince Dane's spies meet, I inform him, trying to shake off my fear. I need to concentrate. Cardin is nothing. An instrument. A gambling marker. He fixes me with an odd, startled look.
How do you know that? What possessed you to bring me here?
I'm trying to figure out what to do next, I say, with uncomfortable honesty.
And if one of the spies returns?
He asks me, rousing from his stupor enough to actually seem concerned.
They're going to discover you in their lair and...
He trails off at the smirk on my face and subsides into stunned silence. I can see the moment he arrives at the realization that I'm one of them. That I belong here.
Cardan lapses back into silence. Finally. Finally, I've made him flinch. I do something I would never dare to do before. I go through Prince Dane's desk. There are mounds of correspondence. Lists. Notes, neither to Dane nor from him. Probably stolen. More in his hand. Movements, riddles, proposals for laws. Formal invitations. Informal and innocuous letters, including a few from Matic. I am not sure what I am looking for. I am just scanning everything as quickly as I can for something, anything that might give me some idea of why he was betrayed. All my life, I grew up thinking of the High King and Prince